Welcome to the Mug Meeting Summaries podcast. I'm Gilbert Dutilleux. Our September meeting started with the usual roundtable discussion. Topics covered included CUPS printer configuration, X window manager configuration, Apache PHP bugs, traffic shaping and net neutrality, and Windows 8.
Software warranty, and you go in there and then you can turn off a whole whack load of stuff, and you can probably tell if you turn off that dialog and just choose the operating system entry into CUPS, and maybe that will.
Well, I know in some distros there's a Firefox-GNOME package that is the specific, is the GNOME integrations for Firefox, and if you don't have that installed, then it uses its own print dialog. If you do have it installed, then it uses the GTK print dialog.
There you go. So that's something
stuff
like
that.
Okay. Worth looking at.
But yeah, it's not a generic overarching problem because I can print duplex, no problem.
Yeah, because I can print it off of everything else, but, well, so far.
You can also just set in CUPS the default for that printer to be double-sided, and then I bet you it'd come out double-sided.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, that's weird.
Was it failing altogether or just printing something single-sided?
Just print single-sided.
Yeah. So it sounds like something in their print dialog that's got a bug in it or something.
Yeah, because their print dialog, I can go in and it says one-sided, click one-sided. That's all there is.
Oh, okay, so there is no duplex in that print dialog. Okay.
Oh, that's a different problem.
Yeah, so you're going to find a way to just turn off that print dialog and use either GNOME's
or that is GNOME's. Stop using GNOME's.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Something like that. Do a search on that, Google in those, either Firefox or Thunderbird, and see a way to turn it off.
Yeah, because this is fairly recent as well, because this spring I was able to do it from both Thunderbird and Firefox. But now that they've done update after update after update, I kind of lost that capability.
But thanks for the help.
All right. Yep, in the corner.
Yeah, okay. This has to do with the video editor OpenShot. For some reason, my wife uses it because she uses it for producing videos for YouTube. Adiron Mint 11 worked fine. We're now at Mint 13 Maya with the Mate interface installed it. We both have an account on that machine. It still works fine under my account. If I go under her account, the process runs, but it doesn't show the interface anymore. Where I'd even look for that. And I've tried uninstalling and reinstalling it from the repositories, reinstalling it. PPA, whatever it is, and it's still, no matter which way I go with it, it works fine under mine, but for hers, for some reason, you go in, the process is running, but it doesn't show the interface.
Have you installed it under her user?
Or
just always with your user?
Did it both ways. I tried a number of different configurations of it.
Setting with the window manager, it's probably just moving the window somewhere you can't see it on your screen.
Maybe try looking for the hidden files in the home directory. Compare yours with hers and see if there's any settings in there that are different.
Did you copy the home directories from your old distribution to your new one?
Or did you do an upgrade?
Yeah, because we put 13. And like I said, when I first installed it, it was working for a while. She did a couple of videos, it was fine. Then I don't know if some update broke something or whatever, but all of a sudden she went in one day, clicked on it, no, it's not running. I looked under the sys monitor, the process is running, no interface. Went under my account, still works fine.
It's possible that there were dot files in the home directory, hidden files from the old version of OpenShot, from the old distribution, that were carried over. You weren't running OpenShot in the old distribution, so you wouldn't have them in your user. But she would have them on hers, and maybe they're out of date and no longer compatible.
Like I said, when we went from 11 to 13, we had it under 11, we had it under 13, and it was working for a while, and all of a sudden on her side, it just stopped working.
Having run into exactly the problem Rob mentioned a minute ago, it sure looks like it's not running, and it takes you about, well, it took me 20 minutes to figure out what was going on last time that happened to me.
Okay.
If the
process is running, but I can't find the GUI.
I'm not familiar with the Mint GUI. They've got their own special thing happening now. Do you still have Alt-Tab as a way to switch between windows, like there is in most GUIs?
I haven't tried that.
If you can, and most GNOME-based GUIs, when you do Alt-Tab and you leave the Alt key pressed down, mm-hmm. comes up with a little window showing you the windows that it's tabbing between. Okay. These are in a microcosm. Right. I'll bet if what Rob's saying is true, you'll see that show up in the list.
Even if you go to it, you can't get to it.
It's just off screen. Okay. So you might be able to maximize it. You might be able to.
Did you have a second screen?
Ever have a second monitor?
You go attached
to that system?
No. But I was getting some quirky things, like you say, where it was coming up, and instead of even going full screen, it was like going way off to the side. And I had to play with it. And the screens that I played with and got them to be the right size now work all fine. Mm-hmm. So I had the problem where it was going too big, but at least I saw the screen, I knew it was there, and I could work with it.
Yeah, most likely it's just somewhere off screen, and the settings for the window geometry are stored in one of these dot files.
You didn't change your monitor, did you?
No. Everything else was the same. All we did was, like I said, we had it on 11, I backed up the home directories, put 13 on, and like I said, it was all working good for a while. I don't know if it was something with the new Mate interface, maybe it still has some quirks, and it's...
If you don't mind losing any preferences that might have been set in the application, just look for any dot files under your wife's home directory that were created by that application and just blow them away.
Okay. Or you can back them up somewhere
else. You don't want to just delete them. But yeah, it's most likely one of those has a funky setting.
Too. You go in there and just modify the geometry and apply it. Or just actually pass the startup command line with geometry.
Oh, yeah, dash geometry, right.
Well, that's an application.
Understand thing,
right?
Yeah.
That's
an
X
thing.
Okay.
It's
properties.
It's
carried through a lot of
places. I contacted the OpenShot people. They had nothing on it. I went on to the Linux Mint forums, and there was nothing that we can post about.
Try searching on the Linux Mint forums or FAQs or just Google. Window opens off screen. That's a reasonably common issue. If you know how to use the keyboard commands, you can usually do Alt space to bring up the window menu, but that doesn't help you if you're not familiar with the options you get when you do that. And deleting the stored preferences, if this is the problem, deleting the stored window position, that's somewhere in the window manager, not in the application. Mm-hmm. So you might have to delete .gnome, you might have to delete .gnome2, you might have to delete .gtk, you might have to delete .mate. I don't know which set of preferences controls your window manager.
And that can be a mess.
Also, comp is versus whatever. Like, depending on what kind of decorator you're using, it can take over shit.
Yeah, why don't we just plug in a second monitor and see what pops up?
At least.
As a last resort.
And Dan's suggestion, use dash geometry on the command line. Most X11 programs obey it, not all. And it would just be, so from the command line, open shot. Dash geometry 0x0. Yeah. Upper left. And that'll be at 0 plus 0.
Upper left. Zero plus zero.
Oh, if right. X sorry. 0x0 will give you a 0x0 pixel. Window.
Yeah.
That's not good.
That'd be even worse.
Zero. Good point. So like 100x100.
Well, it's on screen.
Plus 0 plus 0?
Plus 0. Yeah.
Plus 0.
0 plus 0.
No, plus 0 plus 0.
Yeah, you're right.
Because otherwise it'll take the first one to be your width.
Oh, okay. I suppose.
So yeah, dash geometry, space, plus 0 plus 0. No spaces.
Or you can even force the width and height if you want to, in case those have somehow gotten...
Set to 0, 0 by accident.
Okay, thank you.
I'll take advantage of the lull to update you on one of my previous stumpers of the month. Still no solution to this. The problem was with Apache, with the PHP module built in. Every once in a while, and it's not an easily replicated bug, but every once in a while, it would serve up the unprocessed, unparsed PHP source to the browser, which is not good. Last time I reported this, I'd done Google searches for that and had come up empty. This time I came up with one relevant search result. I mean, there were still a bunch of others, but one relevant one, and apparently other people have experienced this, including Facebook. the article that described this only gave workarounds which are meant to sort of mitigate limit your exposure. It didn't really suggest a solution to the problem. The other thing that I think I have determined that killing and restarting Apache seems to get rid of the problem. So it could be some sort of memory leak thing or something weird within Apache. It could also be, and I don't know for sure, but this only shows up after we've been running Apache for a long time on the server, and during that time period, updates got installed as well. So it could be when one of the libraries gets pulled out from under, the rug pulled out from under Apache, it might do something funny. Like, it's still running, it's still linked to the old binaries for the libraries, but support files and things like that change. So maybe some library calls don't work correctly anymore, and all of a sudden, it doesn't do what it's expecting to do. Anyway, so the workaround I found is to just kill and restart Apache. But the unfortunate thing is, I only think to do this after someone has reported the problem, which is kind of...
cron.
And you're cronning a restart of a production service. Like, come on.
Yeah.
I got two servers where I have to do it. But of course, usually it's because it's really crappy third-party code that I have no choice but to run, but still.
Some systems do that as a default. We'll restart the service every night.
Hackers are not going to like that if Apache restarts when they're trying to get in. It's like,
hey, where's my PHP code?
Yeah, so anyway, I haven't really gotten any further with finding a solution to this, but at least I now know I'm not alone in the world.
Actually, I have to wonder. I've seen something sometimes where it'll flash up like a very simple HTML of the web page, and then all of a sudden it loads the pretty one, and I don't know if that's just some of the scripts running in the background or if it's some sort of bug.
I see that a lot.
That is usually when things like the cascading style sheets are a separate load.
Right.
So it shows you the thing before it gets all the rest of the stuff, and then repaints the screen once it's got all the styles and all
that.
Are
you running prefork or worker?
Prefork.
Have you set the maximum number of clients served? That will cause each worker process to restart after a certain period of time.
Right.
Which means...
Okay.
Yeah,
that's a good idea.
I can't remember which of those settings I've changed, so I'll have a look at that.
Well, if you're running log PHP, you're almost definitely still running prefork.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, max clients and max requests would both have much the same effect. Or you can switch to using FastCGI, which is reportedly now a preferred method for deploying PHP, not mod PHP.
If you unload and reload PHP, does it have the same effect as restarting Apache? Is it the module?
You have to reload Apache once you modify those.
Right.
Okay. I haven't tried that. I mean, I figured the simplest thing and the most foolproof was to just kill and restart the server completely.
Can they do that?
I don't know.
I
thought there was a way.
One big thing.
I have warned you. But when this
for stars, does it continue for a while? Is it persistent when you get this?
Yes, but the weird thing is it's persistent, but it's not consistent. In other words, sometimes you go to this particular page and you get the parsed content. And other times you go to that same page again and you get...
So approximately what percentage of the time does it happen?
I don't know. Okay. It's been pretty sporadic, so I haven't gathered
any exactly what I'm working on for process. I'm just wondering if once it trips, it then sort of gets more frequent again.
Over.
Yeah. So it's getting into some kind of condition that can cause it to repeat.
Yeah, I don't know.
Anything weird in the error logs?
No. Nothing logged.
Yeah.
Idea of getting your clients.
I mean, the only thing that is weird is that when you look at the access, like there's nothing that shows up in the error log. When you look at the access log, the number of bytes delivered is actually the number of bytes in the raw PHP file, which was kind of a confirmation that what was being sent was the raw PHP.
I can also tell you how often it's happening. Give you a little, little check.
Yeah.
Probably like 0.00001%.
Yeah.
I'd start suspecting flaky hardware, or like you were thinking, like memory corruption, or
I don't think it's a hardware issue.
Nothing else ever goes wrong on the server.
Oh yeah. But
if it were flaky hardware, you wouldn't expect restarting Apache necessarily to make it.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
But like I said last
you
time,
you never know. Yeah. But
I mean, Adam's done a lot of mod PHP. I've done more than like a zillion years of it, and we've never seen anything remotely like that.
It's highly unlikely it's a memory corruption thing, because this is a system with ECC memory, and I never get any ECC errors logged.
Do you actually have EDAC modules loaded? Because if not, you'll never see error messages logged about your memory.
I get EDAC errors from another system that's running the same... same version of the OS.
Sorry.
It is less likely with ECC, though. You're right.
This whole thing started with an OS upgrade, was that right?
It
started after a bunch of upgrades were installed. The only thing I've noticed that seems to be consistent is this problem only shows up after Apache's been running for a very long time, and during that time interval, updates have been installed. There's a direct correlation between the two, I don't know.
How consistent is a very long time?
Check the logs in
weeks or months.
We're talking weeks.
Weeks?
I run servers for years without ever restarting them. It's serving up like millions of web pages a day. And it's just the most bizarre thing.
Gilbert, if you just do like a fprep, figure out, like just grab the timestamps out of them, those specific things, put them on a graph. That way you can at least see if it is following a pattern. Mm-hmm. That's what I would do, but that's me.
Just a bit of a comment. If you can check your update logs and see if and when there has been an update to Apache, because you say this occurs after there's an Apache update, and
no, this last time it wasn't an Apache update, but there was a libc update.
Oh.
Yeah. And several other libraries as well. So,
because if you can narrow it down to what's actually causing your problems, just take a look at if the object that's causing the problems has been updated, and then do a restart.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's a cheap workaround, but,
The problem right now is I don't know what specific component is triggering it.
What if you were able to benchmark it, obviously not during peak time, but using, like, the Apache benchmark tool, you might be able to get, like, if you were to stress the server enough, maybe it's related to that, or... and see maybe which requests are causing it to mess up. Other than that, if it's time or update related.
Yeah,
time. How many times are
they doing?
49.8 days.
Well, if it was the updates, you'd think it would, you know, break and stay broken. Not break and stay,
but then,
rarely intermittent.
But then,
you know,
right. Yeah.
So that's very bizarre.
Yeah.
Might be a red wild goose chase on that one. Mm-hmm. Good luck. Good luck. We'll wait another 3 months.
And
there's another web page.
Give you guys a bit of a smile. I've encountered the same thing, except this is client side thing. When I'm downloading BitTorrent on SHA, SHA will slow your whole network down to such a point that you get exactly the same thing. Like, you go to a PHP page, and occasionally you'll see the PHP code instead of the code that's actually being sent out. But
you'll
what's being sent out?
You'll see the HTML code.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not PHP code. HTML.
Both actually.
You do not get sent PHP code to your browser.
Well, unless you're on Jill.
Unless
Bear's
you're on
server.
Unless there's something wrong on the server side, you never should see the PHP code.
You might see some Python if they're running crazy JavaScript, because they do have Python and JavaScript now.
Oh god.
But that's kind of a messed up situation.
Have you set the encryption on your Tor clients?
Yes.
And they're still slowing you?
And they're still slowing. Random ports, random everything as well.
I will note, having now moved up to a higher SHA speed tier, mm-hmm. that I do not run torrents. And frequently the network just feels slow, subjectively.
Yeah.
It isn't all that slow if you measure it objectively.
Yeah.
But subjectively it starts to feel like, you know, like you're on DSL. But now, since I'm now a business customer, I apparently have access to techs who know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Hooray.
And they have confirmed, and after I knew what to look for, I was able to not prove it, but generate some very strong circumstantial evidence that they are actually right. SHA's core can't handle the traffic.
Mm.
So basically, SHA's entire network in Manitoba is badly oversubscribed.
Which is actually kind of interesting, because when they first came out, they were making a point to say that they were actually 12 times over capacity.
Yeah. Well, it may not be any, like, depends which part you're talking about.
Exactly.
Now, on my connection, it's the local node that serves mm-hmm. my neighborhood that's oversubscribed. Mm-hmm. Not the one up the chain from it, or the one up the chain from mm-hmm. it, or the one up the chain from it. It's the one closest to... It's whatever the device is that actually feeds the chunk of cable running through my little piece of neighborhood.
Did you figure that out?
Yeah, I've just checked that. Latency or something?
The latency analysis, and with the help of a neighbor.
Wi-Fi?
No, I would never do that. Come on. With the unwitting assistance of a neighbor. Yeah. And able to reproduce exactly the same latency spikes on my neighbor's connection. Mm-hmm. I actually had a SHA tech admit that, yes, my neighborhood is oversubscribed. And it's funny, because the other thing I can always tell is it starts to feel slow when everybody is home next door.
Mm-hmm. Next door. Work.
They have, as far as I know, 5 TVs.
All
with
running
5 computers.
All streaming Netflix, yeah.
And they're probably all doing something like streaming Netflix. And I've talked to the owner, and he brags about how he's got the very top XO tier connection from SHA with, like, the 100 megabit service, because he needs it for all his video. And I'm like, yep, great.
Thanks
a whole bunch.
So they're oversubscribed because of one customer.
Well, at the network level, it doesn't,
but
the
only
at certain neighborhood level,
day, right?
Yep.
It doesn't take much. It's semi-random.
Yep.
And it depends, like, where they've most recently done an upgrade. And it depends whether it's aerial cable, buried cable, how old the cable is, how many people are on that segment. There's so many variables that, in most places, SHA doesn't actually do traffic shaping at all anymore.
Don't.
Of any kind.
Don't they still do, like, bursting, initial packet bursting?
Yes, sorry, I should have been more clear. They don't do any traffic shaping past your cable modem. Your cable modem is programmed with a certain bandwidth parameters, but in most cases, that's it. Once you've hit your burst limit or your sustain limit, you're going straight through.
I mean, subjectively, to me, when there's sustained throughput and it feels slow like that, it seems like the first thing that goes is the burst is gone. Mm-hmm. Now you're just generally getting all the pages at a slower rate.
Yep. You are. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what burst is, right? You only get burst if you haven't been using any bandwidth up until the point where you suddenly burst that much. Mm-hmm. That's the whole point of burst bandwidth. Mm-hmm. Is yeah. You only get it if you're statistically not using your all of your bandwidth all of the time.
Right. Yeah, because with torrents, like I've got mine limited to like 10K mm-hmm. both sides, and everything slows down.
Yep, that's right. And that's normal. That's desired behavior.
That's insane.
That's so low, though. Why
doesn't matter. You're still filling the bucket.
I saturate my downstream on a DSL connection from MTS. Mm-hmm. I don't care. Well, that's a good point. I don't care. But
yeah.
Right. I mean, that's insane. 10K?
That's
10K.
Not SHA. That's just the way burst algorithms work in most network gear.
350.
Are you trending this stuff at all with some other graph, like smoke ping or something like that, just to get an idea as to what's going on?
I kind of gave up on my own stuff. Actually, you know what? My router tracks it for me. I'll see if I can pull it up with my laptop up.
Because it's, you know, I've done that from my side for a while. I can see, I, you know, kind of different servers across the country. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, you can tell when network changes are occurring on there. It's like, okay, mm-hmm. I just lost 20 milliseconds,
yep.
Or I gained 20 milliseconds here or whatever.
Yep.
Is there a aerial connection for the cable between your house and his? If you just go out there and cut that every day, why are you the other way?
No, pellet guns.
Yeah, I'll put it however you want to cut it. Just make sure it gets cut every time they fix it.
A squirrel up there. Or just swap when he's not looking.
Actually, it could be a plug and you don't have to break it. You just got to pull it.
Well, you got to make it so that people, they got to work at it. And they're going, okay, let's wire this somehow different. Somehow, something's hitting this all the time. So let's wire this differently.
Scroll warfare.
Just coat the cable with peanut butter somehow.
Yeah. Come on, it's a little bit incredibly. Yeah, because in the early days, I was told by Francois that if it turns out that you were actually getting a slow connection, mm-hmm. you could request that they actually split the node.
Yeah. Yep, it's on the to-do list, apparently. Mm-hmm. Like, mine is already on the list, but the list is, like, 3 years long.
Mm-hmm. Really?
So,
3 years?
Oh, yeah. Every ISP has a list of to-do items that's at least 2 or 3 years long. If you don't, you're not in business.
Shaw?
Everyone will. MTS will, Shaw will, and just things get reprioritized as certain important customers start screaming and others stop screaming because they got used to it, and no, there's no such thing as an ISP who's still in business who doesn't have a list of things they need to do that's at least 2 years long.
And there's no such thing as an ISP who'll admit it.
Of course not. Well, it's not in their best interests to do so.
Wouldn't traffic shaping be in their best interests? Because, I mean, what the users see usually is latency. You don't notice if your download is 10 minutes or 10 minutes plus 10 seconds. You don't notice that, but you notice the latency.
Well, there's two answers to that. One is that most downloading clients like Torrent, BitTorrent, and similar protocols, traffic shaping masks problems, number one. So you don't even know you have a problem that you need to fix. And two, as of about... I'm guessing here, because I can't remember exactly, but I think it was about 18 months ago with the CRTC decision against Bell, traffic shaping suddenly became a very unpleasant option for any Canadian ISP, legally. You can do it only if it's necessary for the correct technical functioning of your network.
And you can prove it.
And you have to prove it repeatedly, over and over again, to the CRTC. Because every time somebody comes and makes a complaint and challenges it, you have to prove it again. So it's much easier to just rip the traffic shapers out and say, you know what, screw it.
It was interesting, though. Sarah actually had broadcast something similar on that broadcast about how traffic shaping is actually analogous to your hydro network, and that toaster over there can actually less hydro, so it toasts longer. It was actually a very good presentation. It's on Cira somewhere there. So.
Well, I guess the other thing.
Well, it's about a service, right? It's a public utility service, basically. It's an infrastructure service, like roads and bridges and everything else like that. So it has to have consistent and non-partisan type of
regulation. And I should make one other clarification, is that across the country, it's more visible in smaller ISPs, but even some of the larger ones, there is still some form of traffic shaping in the sense that your CPE device, like the modem that's sitting in your house, now has enough intelligence and enough horsepower to dynamically limit you to a certain amount of bandwidth. So in that sense, you could say the traffic shaping has just been pushed right out to the edge. And the idea is you can do whatever you want with the capacity that the ISP is giving you. If you choose to run BitTorrent and slow everything down, that's your problem. Because well, that's an engineering problem that they acknowledge that, yes, they have to fix. They'll get around to it someday soon. Real soon now.
It's not a regulatory problem, though.
Right, but by eliminating traffic shapers. Now, Bell Canada still uses traffic shapers. They are, in fact, Sandvine Network's largest customer. Who makes traffic shaping gear, guys out of Waterloo. But for the most part, what they're doing is only the technical, we must traffic shape for the network to continue functioning, and they're doing it to mitigate oversubscription. They're not doing it to penalize certain applications, or at least not very much. If they are, the only place you'll ever see it now is they're penalizing things that are known to be bulk download. And they're not penalizing them. They're just saying, you come last. If I have an SSH packet in the buffer, I'm going to send it first, and then I'm going to send the BitTorrent packet. It's not cutting you off at the knees if you're using BitTorrent. It's very, very, very lightweight. And mostly for bandwidth purposes, not for prioritization purposes. I mean, every ISP will take a slightly different tack, and I don't think there's any ISP that's completely homogenous. So, you know, your connection on a shaw cable modem might still have a traffic shaper, and maybe mine doesn't. And that might change next week. Well,
I've noticed a big change in the latency that I have.
Gotten worse or better?
I changed my subscription with Shaw.
You get better or worse?
Still much worse.
Well, I would call and complain about that.
Complain lots, otherwise you're waiting 3 years.
Well, yeah.
I bought an iMac and it really improved my speed. I don't know if that's an answer, but... this seems like an obvious question, maybe, but is it sustained throughput that is, like, the worst enemy that leads to the oversubscription?
Yeah.
Piles up so quickly.
I'm sure there's a few people in this room who will cringe when I utter these words, but there's also the concept of buffer bloat, which, if you go do the research, mathematically it is a valid thing. It's just, it's very hard to get a handle on it, and it's very hard to mitigate, because every single device in the network has buffers that are 10 to 100 times too big. So if you're continuously transmitting data and there's always something in the buffer waiting to be queued to be sent, that will kill your latency. Absolutely. That is the worst possible thing you can do for latency. And BitTorrent happens to do exactly that. So it's not so much a policy decision, it's a technical repercussion of the fact that you're never letting that buffer empty. If BitTorrent had a bursty mode, where it went like gulp of data and then sat back and did nothing for 5 seconds and then burst at full speed for 5 seconds and then did nothing for 5 seconds. That would actually probably be better for most people, right? Mm-hmm. But that's counterintuitive, and, well, really that's solving the wrong problem anyway. Yeah. Yeah, the latency engineering is hard. To put it mildly. and everything you introduce into the network to try and fix latency adds a little bit of latency itself. So
every time it buffers, it gets a little bit worse.
Yeah, like I put a traffic shaper into a production network, and I watched best case latency go or increase. So, like my, I don't know if you want to call that best case or worst case. My minimum latency went up by 1 millisecond. My average latency went down by 10. Well, which am I more worried about? If I'm worried about my average latency, then maybe that was worth putting that device in. If I'm worried about absolute minimum in the best case scenario, then putting that in was a bad idea. Which problem are you trying to solve? You know, and so on the one hand, it's every action has an equal and opposite reaction. On the other hand, it's the law of unintended consequences. On yet another hand, there's so many angles to it that every time you solve one angle, you've introduced something else that now has to be solved. There's no way to fully optimize for every possible case.
Yeah.
So most ISPs go for the minimum amount of effort scenario. And minimum cost, of course.
Yeah.
So I'll take off my ISP hat.
So I've got a question. How many people, I realize it's the Unix users group, but I want to test this. So I'm running 8, like Windows 8. How many people like it?
I haven't touched it yet.
Find out how many people have used it
first.
Yeah. If it was on a tablet, maybe.
Yeah. How many people have used it?
Is it even cutesier than the previous version?
Oh, yeah, very cutesy.
Oh.
You're going to hate it.
I don't know how you're going to really hate it.
What, I mean, I've been using it at my work production laptop.
What?
At first it felt like just a couple more clicks to do everything that I could do more quickly before. But what don't you like about it?
I ran into a couple bugs that are pretty painful.
Such as?
Such as when you open up the web app, like the webcam application, and it's still running in the background because you can't close the fucking thing unless you go in the task manager and kill it. It had a bug where it kept the keyboard hotkeys. So when I locked my computer, went back, I hit P, it opens up this side thing, and I can't type P into my password field. I had to turn off the computer because the process was hooking into my keyboard and doing a hotkey thing instead of typing the right character. Stuff like that.
You realize you just decreased your password entropy by 8 bits, right?
Congratulations, it's 32 characters, go nuts.
You can't use password for your password anymore.
But it's very secure because no one else can either.
You're right.
You're secure on your keyboard.
Okay, yeah, I'm just alone. I'll just switch back. I was just kind of curious to see if anybody else had been using it and been like, I hate it or I love it.
You're right about what you want.
I used Windows Phone, which is a very similar interface, not identical, but very similar. And for people who single task, it's great.
Right.
Yeah. Alright. And that, unfortunately, and I understand that most people in this room will have trouble grasping the concept, that's 90% of the computer using population.
Yep. True.
So Metro's perfect for them.
Exactly. They don't have any distractions from the primary task at hand. Was
accidentally drag your window off your screen and not be able to find it.
Okay, now that we've gone full circle, and now that it's 25 after, I think I'm going to call time.
That's it for this podcast. Thanks for listening. For more Mug Meeting summaries, or for more information about the Manitoba Unix User Group, check out our website at muug.mb.ca.